It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We live in the era of design catch-up that's keeping up with the newest, the most improved. Now, it's fun to think what's possible, like a Mario Batali hologram for your kitchen or a foraging drone that brings home supper. But how about the things like the wine bottle? Its design hasn't changed much in 150 years. But why is that the design?
You know, what's interesting is the sort of standardized size of the bottle, which we all take for granted, you know, 750 milliliters. It wasn't really standardized until you get the Industrial Revolution, and it comes out of basically the size of a lungful of a glassblower, you know, of air from a glassblower. That's basically how they initially came up with it. It's like, this is what I can exhale, and so that's the size of your bottle. Here you go.
That's Food & Wine's Ray Isle. Lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Every day there's redesigns on the things that we use. You know, apps, can openers, smartphones, and dishwashers even. Few things are static. But then there's the wine bottle. Now, that design is still back in the 1800s. Ray Isle, executive wine editor for Food & Wine magazine, has recently unearthed some innovative and perhaps wacky ideas for wine bottles redo. But wacky though some may be, they could be the beginning of a paradigm shift in the wine world. Ray, good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Lynn. Thanks.
So, let's just briefly, before we get to the new ideas, can you briefly explain the shapes of wine bottles that we see on the shelves and why
Absolutely.
Are they that way?
Well, they're that way. There's two basic shapes, let's say, you know, which is the Bordeaux bottle and the Burgundy bottle. The Bordeaux bottle is the one you see Cabernets in. It has the kind of more square-shouldered bottle. And the Burgundy one is the what you see Chardonnays in. It's a smoother bottle. The Bordeaux bottle was designed essentially to catch sediment. You have the neck of the bottle and that little outcrop, and that's when you pour, that catches the sediment in the bottle. But you know what's interesting is the sort of standardized size of the bottle, which we all take for granted, you know, 750 milliliters. It wasn't really standardized until you get the Industrial Revolution, and it comes out of basically the size of a lungful of a glassblower, you know, of air from a glassblower.
Oh, really?
That's basically how they initially came up with it. It's like, this is what I can exhale, and so that's the size of your bottle. Here you go.
But it's handy. It's
yeah, it works out well. And it's, you know, it's funny because there was so – because until the 1800s, there was so much variation in bottle size. In England, for instance, it was illegal to sell wine in bottles until the 1860s because everybody's getting ripped off by people subtly changing the size of the bottle and had to be sold by the measure and then put into a bottle.
Yeah.
You know, the development of glass bottles was what allowed wine to be put down and aged over time and develop over time. Before that, you had wine was stored in barrels or in clay pots, you know, these long, thin amphorae in the sort of, you know, classical ancient world. It wasn't something aged over time because there wasn't a way to do it. So the development of the standardized glass bottle had played a huge role in that. It is something that's changed over the years. It's been pretty steady for the past couple of hundred, but now there's all this new technology coming along and concerns about environmental cost of weight of bottles and things like that. So it's kind of a fascinating, you know, moment of possible paradigm shift.
Well, can you walk us through – there are these designs that I found on the Food & Wine website that are imagined, but some of them look like at least there's a prototype. You think you can paint a portrait to explain to us what they are?
Sure. We picked a couple of things out of the market that were interesting, and we also went to a couple of design firms and said, essentially, if you were going to rethink the wine bottle, what would you do? So one of the first ones we pulled is from a winery called Truett Hurst, which is – and this is actually out in the market, Paperboy Wines, and it's a recycled paper bottle. It has a – it's a bottle shape, but it's made out of recycled paper with a thin plastic film inside. It's 100% recyclable cardboard bottles. They're 85% lighter than glass, but they actually have a screw top on, and they look weirdly like a bottle. And then – we went to a company called Ferrone Design out of Chicago, and they came up with – it's like a slope-shouldered wine bottle with an angled neck where the cork goes in. You know, everybody's had this problem where you pour wine out of the bottle and it drips all over the place.
Yeah.
So their thought was, well, why not come up with a wine bottle that actually doesn't drip? It's a little like the cup holder in a car where you think, how did it take us 60 years to come up with this? So I like the idea of a wine bottle that doesn't drip. And then we also went to – Malfatti Glass, which does kind of what beautiful glass, tabletop glassware and things. And they just came up with this nifty idea of having little single-serving bottles that are in the shape of the letters W-I-N-E with a little cork stuck in it where you could place them on the table. Everybody would have their own letter. It's kind of a nifty idea.
I like that. You know, I like that a lot.
It's a lot of fun. And another one we got from a design studio called Minimalist, and this is floating on some of the web design sites, called Vin Grace. And it's a – you've seen the standard sort of square Tetra Pak, and this is more of a triangular plane. This is a hard one to describe without the visual.
Yeah, it's almost like a hexagon within a rectangle.
Yeah, and very, very cool and modern-looking black and white packaging, an angular cut corner so you, again, minimize drips.
Okay, with the concerns over carbon footprints and the concerns over keeping wine at its very best, what do you predict the future is going to be for the wine bottle?
Well, it's an interesting question because in terms of environmental concerns, there's no question that something like a Tetra Pak, which is so much lighter, is, you know,
those are the box wines, right?
Those are the box wines, yeah, or the little individual 1 liter size wines, like you see, like the Bandit brand, Bandit Pinot Grigio, or Yellow and Blue Malbec. You know, without question, they have a lighter carbon footprint because they just don't cost as much to ship because you're not shipping tons and tons of glass. Mm-hmm. You know, 1,000 cases of wine is about 12,000 pounds of glass. 1,000 cases of Tetra Pak wine is about a twelfth of that. That said, in terms of aging high-end fine wine, glass is still the most neutral, best solution they've come up with. Because what you want is something that doesn't interact with the wine over time. And one interesting thing that the Champagne region has done is essentially the standardized bottle that is approved by the region for use. A couple of years ago, they redesigned it and shaved off about 2.5 ounces by thinning the neck slightly, changing the slope of the shoulder. And Champagne bottles are heavy to begin with, so they don't blow up because they're full of champagne. They're under pressure. But just by reducing the kind of contours of the bottle, they cut off about 2.5 ounces of weight. And if you look at champagne producing 300 million or more bottles a year, that's actually a fair amount of carbon footprint that got cut off by very subtle changes.
Ray, what about corks? We have glass. We have plastic corks. We have the traditional cork. What's happening?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The pressure on the cork industry from the kind of mass adoption of screw-top closures has actually caused the quality of corks to climb back up again. The problem with corks is that a certain small percentage of them, they taint the character of the wine. They make it smell a little bit like cardboard or a lot like cardboard if it's particularly bad. And that got pretty bad for a while. The adoption of screw caps by higher-end wines, by not your basic, bottom of the basement plonk. That was a response to winemakers saying, I'm tired of these corks messing up my wine. But at the same time, you've got nifty things like these glass stoppers with a little gasket. They first appeared in Austria, I think, and you see them especially in white wines. And you've also seen a change in screw tops. Both the technology of screw tops has gotten so smart in a sense that as a producer, you can buy screw tops. You can kind of dial in the amount of oxygen transmission over time with a screw top. You buy a certain level of oxygen transmission. So in a sense, it mimics a cork because corks are a little bit transparent to oxygen. That's part of how wine ages. So that's fascinating. The other thing is they've also just refined the way they look. You've got a very streamlined, nice, smooth-sided design. It doesn't look like a screw top. We think of the key thing about wine as being the wine in the bottle. But actually, the package that surrounds it is kind of fascinating in a lot of ways. Who knows what will come next? It's an energy field that will surround your wine and age it over time.
And it'll float in midair.
Yeah, or a fourth-dimensional bottle sort of stores your wine in outer space somewhere.
Ray, as always, fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Ray Isle is executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine. What kind of life can a bay leaf have? I mean, in recipes, they sound like an afterthought. You rarely use enough to taste them. It's demeaning. And the saddest thing is, we usually buy dried-out ones. All their sexy fragrance is long gone. To quote Peggy Lee, is that all there is? Well, to gain clarity, our contributor, David Leet, talked to J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, the managing culinary director of Sirius Eats.
So tell me, what do we need to know about bay leaves? I mean, they're so often an optional ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you would think that they're an optional ingredient, and they do have a very subtle flavor compared to many other herbs and spices. Mm-hmm. You know, and oftentimes, you know, when I was a young cook, I would throw a couple bay leaves into a stew because the recipe told me to. And then at the end, you'd fish them out and throw them away. And you'd say, you know, I can't even taste these. But then if you actually go and do some actual A-B testing, you know, mm-hmm. make one stew with them and one stew without them, you'll find that they actually do contribute sort of a slight sweetness. They bring out the meaty flavors of beef and chicken. And they even help if you're making a vegetable soup. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a savory quality to the whole thing. So, yeah, they are an optional ingredient, but things are definitely better with them.
Okay. Now, there's Turkish bay leaf and there's mm-hmm. California bay leaf. And I know that you have very strong feelings about them. So tell me, what are the different flavors? How do they compare?
Well, so the California bay leaves tend to have a much stronger menthol flavor. Mm-hmm. So a little bit more of that eucalyptus note. And just in general, they're a little bit more one-dimensional than the Turkish bay leaves. The Turkish bay leaves are milder, more nuanced, a little bit sweeter in flavor. Mm-hmm. And they don't really hit you over the head the way the California bay leaves do. And that's actually an important thing because I remember once, maybe 10 years ago or so, and this was the first time I'd ever seen fresh bay leaves. If you're getting fresh bay leaves in the U.S., they're almost always California bay leaves. It's the first time I'd seen fresh bay leaves, and I was like, you know, oh my God, this is awesome because, you know how like parsley, dried parsley versus fresh parsley,
right.
it's just night and day.
No comparison.
So it was like, you know, this must be so much better than the dried bay leaves. And so I used some in a stew I was making, and then the stew was just overpowered by this menthol flavor, this eucalyptus flavor. And that's because, California bay leaves just have a stronger flavor, which some people like, but you have to be very careful.
Are they the same species?
They are not, actually. They're two different species of similar plants. Mm-hmm. They're shrubs. And you can tell the difference between them. Well, if they're labeled, you're lucky. If they're fresh, they're California. But the easiest way to tell the difference is the shape of the leaf. California bay leaves tend to be kind of long and slender with a point, sort of like a spearhead, whereas Turkish bay leaves tend to be a little bit more oval-shaped. Mm-hmm. And so they'll have either a tiny point on the tip or they might be completely round. But they're sort of shorter and squatter and almost circular. And most recipes call for Turkish bay leaves.
Yes.
If you only have California bay leaves, I would start by using about a quarter to half the amount.
Really? That little?
Yeah, they're much stronger, particularly if they're fresh.
Mm-hmm.
They are the kind of thing that once you get used to that flavor, it might be something that you're actually going for. Some people like to use fresh California bay leaves, particularly in desserts. They go well with sweet flavors.
Right.
Any type of dessert that you would have, say, mint in, mm-hmm. it would be pretty good with it because it has that sort of like Vicks vapor rub. Yeah, that kind of effect.
So, Kenji, if you had your choice, would you go fresh or dried bay leaf?
Well, I would go with dried bay leaves. And actually, bay leaves are one of those herbs similar to oregano or rosemary that grow in very dry, arid, sunny climates. And those herbs actually tend to do better than sort of fresh leafy herbs like parsley and basil at retaining their flavor after they're dried. And that all has to do with the fact that their aromatic compounds are less volatile. And it's because they grow in these hot climates that basically they have these molecules that are designed to stay in place even when the sun's shining down on them, even when water is evaporating. So because of that, when you dry them out, they tend to retain flavor a lot better. I generally go with dried bay leaves.
So with dried bay leaf, a lot of recipes will say put it in and then fish it out at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why are we fishing it out?
Because dry bay leaves are so tough. I mean, they're just not something pleasant to eat. You know, I know some people play games where the person who gets the bay leaf in their stew has to do all the dishes.
I've never done that. I should think of that.
But basically, it's just because they have an unpleasant texture. I know some people have heard or have been told that they're poisonous and they're going to kill you, but.
Mm-hmm. I always heard that if you eat it, it could slice your throat.
Yeah, it's just a bad texture.
It's not something.
It's like eating a fishbone. You don't really want to do it.
And then I am very curious about ground bay leaf because mm-hmm. I think ground bay leaf in a recipe could be really wonderful. I know that there are some recipes where you can put it on like kebabs.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Portugal, they do that. Do you use ground bay leaf?
I don't often use it just because. I try to keep my spice rack minimal because, you know, spices and herbs, dried herbs and spices tend to lose their flavor pretty rapidly. Mm-hmm. So
how often would you replace them?
It varies from spice to spice, and it depends on how you store them. But, you know, anywhere from 3 months to a year, depending on what it is. Mm-hmm. And ground bay leaf is not something that I would personally use often enough to mm-hmm. to warrant buying a bottle of it.
Okay.
Whereas regular dried bay leaves I use all the time. I actually keep my dried bay leaves. I buy them in bulk and keep the jar in the freezer. And they just use them straight from the freezer.
And how long can they last in the freezer?
Oh, they'll last indefinitely.
Well, excellent. Mm-hmm. Kenji, it was a pleasure.
It was great to be here.
J. Kenji Lopez-Ault is the author of the James Beard Award-nominated column, The Food Lab. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Now, we have a recipe for you this week to let bay leaves redeem themselves. Head to the website for spring vegetables and white beans scented with fresh bay. That's splendidtable.org. And while you're there, with Father's Day coming, be sure to look at our Once Upon a Table, Tales of Eating with Mom and Dad. It's a sort of show and tell for Father's Day. We're swapping stories, recipes, and photos. So tell us your favorite dad story, share a recipe, and of course, we love photos. So to say thanks, we'll send you our Father's Day menu with dishes like homemade onion dip, spice-crusted oven spare ribs, ginger sesame coleslaw, and a brownie sundae with smoked almonds and caramel. We've created these recipes especially for this event, and the only way to get your hands on them is to go to splendidtable.org. Coming up, that profound question, what is America's fried chicken? And of course, you know it's not what you think it is. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There's an Italian saying, if you could fry a shoe, people would eat it. I mean, is there anyone who doesn't love fried food? It's the crunch and the crisp and that thing about something succulent hidden inside. And fried chicken, that's the peak. Well, two like-minded souls trek the country stalking the best fried chicken recipes. Lee Brian Traeger and Adina Sussman authored Fried and True, more than 50 recipes for America's best fried chicken and sides. Well, our contributor, Melissa Clark, immediately stepped up for this assignment. She talked with Lee and Adina at the end of their journey in New York City.
We have Adina here in the studio. Hello, Adina.
Hello.
And we have Lee, who's on the phone. Hello, Lee.
Hello, Melissa.
You guys write in the book that fried chicken is having an it moment. What is it about fried chicken? Lee, why is it such an obsession with you?
It's the ultimate comfort food. Whether it's a white tablecloth restaurant, a pop-up side of the street, or even a supermarket or Popeyes, everybody seems to have a favorite fried chicken story is what we learned in writing the book.
Adina, why do you think fried chicken is having a moment right now?
I think it's kind of the next iconic American food that's getting its due. Sort of like hamburgers and barbecue have sort of been revived and celebrated and kicked up a notch. I think chefs are doing the same thing now with fried chicken.
And when you were writing the book together, were you surprised at the breadth of the fried chicken recipes that you came across while you were talking to chefs and you were traveling? Lee, was it a surprise to you or did you know?
Well, I don't think that I knew just how much interest there would be. I think one of the biggest concerns that I kept badgering Adina about it is I'm saying, how different could recipes be? You know, how are we going to, A, photograph it to make them look different, and B, how different could a recipe be? And boy, was that the sorriest thing that I ever said. I mean, there are as many fried chicken recipes as there are hamburger recipes or any other recipe out there, and everybody has their own take.
Adina, did you come out of writing this book with a favorite fried chicken recipe?
Definitely. I have a hands-down favorite. It came from a fantastic chef named Asha Gomez, who has a restaurant in Atlanta called Cardamom Hill. Asha is from Kerala in the southern part of India, and her chicken fuses southern Indian and southern American traditions. And it just makes so much sense when she tells us about the history of the part of India where she came from, the Portuguese influence, how in that part of India there are many Christians, so they eat pork. Sorghum is used just like in the south. Rice, obviously. and all kinds of spices. So Asha has fused that tradition with American fried chicken traditions.
And what does she do? What is her chicken like?
Her first step is she creates an incredible buttermilk brine that blends the buttermilk with a whole host of green herbs and jalapenos, mint, cilantro, ginger, fresh garlic, salt, lots of salt. And she blends it up in the blender and cloaks the chicken in this emerald green mixture. So just looking at it is a feast for the eyes to start with. And then she dredges it very simply in flour and skillet fries it. And as the chicken fries, the emerald green color kind of pushes through the dredge, and you can sort of see the green kind of come up and sort of cook into the chicken. So it's this experience of freshness, very heady, lots of aromas and scents. It's really incredible.
What about you, Lee? Did you have a favorite chicken recipe from this book?
You know, I like so many of them. It's hard to pick one, but I think the one that stands out is one of the first ones that we sampled, and it was from a jazz player in New Orleans, and his name is Kermit. And his restaurant that we went to is now closed, but I understand he recently reopened. And it was really probably one of the most fun experiences because we were going into this nightclub in probably not the most, it's actually the Treme area of New Orleans. And we kind of pulled up to it and said, okay, are we going in here? And we walked in, and it was warm, and the doors were open. The club was obviously closed in the daytime. And we asked this big gentleman where Kermit was, and he pointed to the corner, and there in the corner of the room is this kind of large man laid out across some dining room tables, and he's getting a massage in the middle of the day. And we said, hey, we're here for your fried chicken. And he got up a few minutes later. He put on his Kermit green chef's jacket, took us into the kitchen, made the simplest, best fried chicken. And that really stands out. But I think it's a combination of the whole experience of meeting Kermit and his colleagues who were working with him in the kitchen that day. I think one was named Dirty Rice. And Adina, was the other one called Ray Boom Boom?
Yeah, so Dirty Rice was sort of his doorman slash friend, who's also manning the barbecue outside where Kermit personally barbecues chicken before every show. So as we see, he's a multi-genre chicken preparer.
And trumpeter.
Yes, exactly. And he's a regular on the late great television show Treme, which chronicles life in New Orleans after Katrina. And our chef was Ray Boom Boom, who, sort of like Madonna or Cher, only has one name and has cooked at a lot of the best restaurants in New Orleans over the years. And Ray and Kermit showed us how they made their incredible chicken.
And what was it about that chicken, Lee? What was so great about it?
You know, it was a simplicity. And I remember him taking it out of the refrigerator, dredging it in flour and clapping. And, you know, I thought clapping was unique to me. Then, of course, I learned that all America is clapping their hands when they're making fried chicken, both while doing it and probably at the end to applaud themselves on such delicious dish.
The clapping helps remove any additional extraneous flour before frying. And we saw that a lot in New Orleans. In addition to, pretty much every chef in New Orleans recommended using chilled chicken, which they believe helps the skin adhere to the chicken and also render.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds counterintuitive, but they believe that it creates a crispier finished product.
Lee, you write about an experimental chef in New York named Wiley Dufresne and his take on Popeye's chicken.
Well, I think even before we started this book, I had heard that when Wiley Dufresne got married that they had Popeye's fried chicken at their wedding. So I knew this was somebody from the get-go that we had to include in the book. But more importantly, before Wiley, getting Popeye's included in the book was something that Adina and I really wanted. And Adina wrote this wonderful letter to the chief marketing officer of Popeye's telling them that we were going to be on this road trip and that Popeye's was a personal favorite of mine. And we got this very, very nice cordial letter back basically thanking us, but they couldn't possibly consider seeing us or letting us into their test kitchen. And I chimed in and I said, hey, I've been talking about Popeye's being my favorite chicken for years. I have it in print. I've written about it. Plus, a lot of the culinary world really loves Popeye, and it would be a great disservice not to allow us into their headquarters in Atlanta. And lo and behold, after a bunch of emails back and forth, I think we wore this lovely gentleman down, and he finally agreed to see us at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday morning. And I remember pulling up there and saying to Adina and our wonderful photographer, Evan Sung, let's look at our watches. We will be out of here in a half hour. And it was probably a good 2.5-3 hours later when we were really rolling out of Popeye's. And not only did they sit with us and talk with us, but they took us up to their test kitchen and allowed us to kind of watch the whole experience of Popeye's fried chicken being made. Although they did not share the recipe with us, we were able to kind of figure the recipe out. And probably my favorite chapter or one of my favorite subjects in the book is Wiley Dufresne creating the Popeyes recipe for us for the book. And I tried it over the weekend, and it was so good I was almost tempted to run to a Popeyes just to do a taste test comparison. But I think we kind of nailed it on the head right there.
In a way that's very easy for the home cook to execute, which knowing that it's a Popeyes recipe and a Wiley Dufresne recipe was
right.
Kind of a culinary miracle.
Adina Lee, thank you so much for chatting chicken with us.
It's our pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
And it was my deep fried pleasure to be with you guys.
Lee Ryan Traeger and Adina Sussman are the authors of Fried and True, and they left us with two recipes to get both sides of what's going on with America's fried chicken. Kermit Ruffin's hard fried chicken and that Carolyn fried chicken that Adina talked about. And you can find them both at splendidtable.org. When I rule the world, each of us are going to get to eat basic foods where they're all but worshipped, like eating rice in Iran. In her book, The New Persian Kitchen, Louisa Shafia captures what thousands of years of rice making means there. Our producer, Jen Russell, talked with Louisa about a particular rice dish, tadig. It translates as bottom of the pot.
Hi, Louisa. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, Jen. Great to be here.
So Persian food comes from Iran. And for those who may not be familiar with it, can you give us a sort of basic nuts and bolts description?
Sure. I think of Persian cuisine as a garden in the desert. That's just sort of my first image of it, and that's how I like to describe it to people. Persian food is filled with fruits and vegetables and herbs because the ancient Persians figured out a way to bring the melted snow water from the mountains that surround Iran into vast desert areas throughout the country. And so from thousands of years ago, they had gardens and orchards, and they grew things like roses and pomegranates and persimmons and dill. And so those ingredients made their way into every dish, from desserts to drinks, to main courses. And because they had so many fruits that were native to Iran, like dates and grapes and oranges, they have a lot of sour flavors in the cuisine. There's lots of tartness, citrus, sort of bright, fresh fruit flavors. So you'll find things like a stew whose base is ground walnuts and pomegranates, or a stew made from rhubarb and lamb, just because they had so much fruit, they had to use it everywhere. And I feel like that's what really makes Persian cuisine distinct.
I love that description. And it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful and colorful and so many flavors. Rice plays a really big role in Persian cuisine, doesn't it?
Yes.
And is there a specific type of rice that is usually used in Persian cooking?
Well, in Iran, they have different grades of rice that they use. For the most part, they use rices that are long-grained and delicate. And then they also do have pudding rice, which is more like what you might know as sticky rice that you would find in sort of more Asian cuisine.
Mm-hmm. And so I understand that the approach to cooking rice is quite different. Can you talk about that?
Well, cooking Persian rice is really an art form that has been developed literally over thousands of years. And so people have been perfecting their technique for a long time. And the result that you want when your rice is done is you want all the grains to be separated. You want them to be light and fluffy. And there are a few ways to get this result. Sort of the most basic way to do it is to take your rice grains and soak them in cold water for about an hour, and then rinse the rice several times. What that does is it takes off the excess starch. So the less starch that you have, the less sticky the rice will be when it's finished cooking. Then you take that rice that you have soaked and rinsed, and you parboil it in very salty boiling water for about 2 minutes, and then you strain it out. And what you want is for the inside to be uncooked, but the outside to be just starting to get tender. And then again, rinse it off. And then the final step, and this is really important, is you get a pan really hot on the stove. You put a generous amount of cooking fat in it. It could be, you know, canola oil or grapeseed oil or even coconut oil, whatever you like to use. Then layer your rice onto that hot oil and then pile the rest of it up into sort of a pyramid shape in the middle of the pan. And it'll hold whatever shape you mold it into because it's damp from being parboiled. Poke a few holes in it so that the steam can release while the rice cooks. Cover it up and put a towel, it could be a kitchen towel or some paper towels, underneath the lid. And then turn the rice down to low and let it cook for about an hour. And the end result should be light, fluffy rice with all separated grains on the top. And then the bottom, you should have a crispy, crunchy layer of golden rice, which is referred to in Persian cooking as tadig. And tadig literally translates as the crunchy rice from the bottom of the pot. And it is the highlight of any Persian meal.
It's so interesting, and it sounds so good. So is that the typical way that rice is cooked?
That is the typical way that it's cooked, and that is just plain rice. Now, that can be jazzed up with anything from herbs to nuts to meat to dried fruit. It could be as simple as adding some saffron on top when it's finished. That is the simplest plain rice recipe.
I love that. There are so many sweet and savory Persian rice dishes. What about sweet or dessert dishes that use rice? Are there many? Is it a popular thing?
Oh, yes. One of the most popular desserts in Iran is called sholazard, saffron rice pudding. It has a little bit of cardamom in it, a little bit of rose water, and some saffron, and it is just delicate. And you cook it, and then you let it cool. So when you eat it, it should be fully chilled. And then it gets topped with cinnamon and pistachios, sometimes some almonds, and it's just very light and delicate.
It sounds delicious. Louisa, thank you.
Thanks. Great talking with you.
Louisa Shafia is author of The New Persian Kitchen and blogs at lucidfood.com. Now you can find Louisa's recipe for Persian shepherd's pie and steps for making a basic tadig on the site splendidtable.org. We're going to be back in a minute with your questions and a greenhouse project with an unexpected mission. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
It is time to connect with you. You can call us at 800-537-5252. You can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. And, of course, you can catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. Julia is calling from Buenos Aires. Julia, that's quite a long distance. Hello.
It is far away. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. What are you doing in Buenos Aires?
Oh, well, it's the story of many American women in my situation. I fell in love with an Argentine man.
What better thing could bring you to that city? That's wonderful.
I think he's pretty great, yeah.
So what's your question?
So because I live here in Buenos Aires, I have lots of ample access to ready-made, very high-quality dulce de leche, which I'm happy to eat right out of the container.
Here, here.
But I also love to bake, and I make a lot of desserts, and I've already made all of the standard desserts with dulce de leche. I've made dulce de leche brownies and dulce de leche cheesecake, and I want to really impress my friends here. I want to impress my family back home when I go to visit, and I'm hoping for some inspiration for dulce de leche-inspired recipes.
Well, first of all, I think before we go any further, for folks who may not be familiar with what it is, why don't you explain it?
So basically, from what I understand, it's basically milk that's been cooked down so much that it becomes this thick, delicious caramel. Or you can also make your own if you cook the sweetened condensed milk in the can in sort of a baña de María, which is just I think has a proper French name.
Right. Just in very gently simmering water. Right.
Exactly.
And the milk condenses and the sugars caramelize, and it just becomes amazing.
Heavenly.
You know what occurs to me? Have you tried doing a panna cotta with it?
I have not.
Okay. Now, panna cotta is basically, you can do it several ways, but it is basically milk or cream or both, or milk and sour cream and cream, or, I mean, the idea is it's gelatin of a milk product.
Okay.
My favorite way of doing it is 3 parts heavy cream to 1 part sour cream, sugar, mm-hmm. sugar to taste, gelatin that you've melted, etc.
That sounds amazing.
But dulce de leche as the main ingredient, backed up with cream or even sour cream, because I'm thinking about the intense sweetness of the dulce de leche. And although sour cream is incredibly rich, it has that tang to it.
Right.
Or there may be a similar product, you know, where you are, that has even more character. You could also even think about yogurt. And what you do is you warm the dulce de leche. Okay. If you're using something like sour cream or yogurt, you don't want to warm that. But you warm the dulce de leche. You have gelatin that you have put over cold water or in cold water, and you know how it expands.
You
let it sit for about 10 minutes. And when you get the dulce de leche fairly warm, you stir in sugar, okay, and you won't need much with the dulce de leche. You may need none. But you can add vanilla to that. You could add a bit of almond to that if you wanted almond extract, not too much, but a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you do is you put in the gelatin and you whisk the gelatin, and I like to take a little bit of the liquid between my fingers just make sure there's no granule of gelatin left. Never let it boil. You just keep it just below the boil. You let that cool a bit until it's closer to room temperature. You have your yogurt or your sour cream in a large bowl, and you whisk that cooled-down, gelatinized dulce de leche in it. Pour it into, you could do it in really pretty demi-tasse cups. You could do it in a large bowl. You can serve it any way you want, but you just let that chill. It needs about 3 or 4 hours in the fridge. You can make it ahead. It holds for a couple of days. You could do a layer of chocolate in the center. Or,
oh my goodness.
Or something wonderfully croquant, like, you know, chocolate with almond or candied almond.
And how would you layer that? Put it in. And
I think what you would do is to put half of the mixture in, let it chill completely, just keep the other half at room temperature, then put the layer of, you know, maybe shaved chocolate or even a fudge combination with crackly almonds. And then you just put that in, and then you'd put the rest of it on top of it and chill it.
Amazing. That sounds so delicious.
It's really fabulous.
Well, I will let you know how it goes.
All right. So, hey, thanks for a great call, and good to know you're enjoying Argentina and that lovely man.
Thank you so much. I'm such a big fan. So thanks for taking my call. It's really a treat to get to talk to you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Bye. You know, this idea, you can make panna cotta with anything, and you don't have to call it panna cotta, but the basic formula applies. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org, and you can add chocolate and coffee and, you know, use whatever creamy thing you want to use. It's one of my great fallback, quick, easy dessert recipes. You can reach us 800-537-5252, or you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Billy is calling from Macon, Georgia. Billy, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call this morning. I want to talk to you. I'm trying to produce Anko, a sweet mochi wrapped around a sweet red bean paste.
Oh, and yes. Yeah.
I love the texture and the flavor of mochi. I've been able to create the red bean paste fairly simply. It's just time consuming to make it. But where I keep going afoul is when I try to make that not too gummy and not too chewy mochi, what I wind up with is something very bready, and it turns pretty quickly very brick hard. I'm hoping you can help me figure out how to duplicate that that feel of mochi that I'm trying to create.
You know what? I think we ought to tell everybody what mochi is about, because not everyone is as crazy about it as me and thee. Why don't you explain it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's made from a rice flour, and it is a very sticky flour. And once you produce it, what it creates is a very, it's not like a gummy bear, which is a texture I particularly like, that chewy, but it's something similar to that. A chewy, soft flavor, a texture that has a sweet flavor. I like the sweet mochi. And so that's what I've been trying to do. And some of the recipes I've tried to follow say steam the mochi dough before you form it into the shape. And then others say steam it after you formed it into the shape. So I don't know if where I'm running afoul.
Okay, first of all, the other thing about mochi, which I think is fascinating, if you ever go to Hawaii or Japan, you're going to realize mochi can become anything, cake, ice cream, savory things. It's really a rice dough, essentially.
Uh-huh.
Okay, this is what I know about mochi.
Great.
That what a lot of people favor is using essentially a sweet rice powder, which is called mochiko. Is that what you're starting with?
Yes, it is, actually. And some recipes call for like a 2-to-1 ratio of sugar to the mochiko.
Right.
And others even add a wheat starch, a little bit of a wheat starch, supposedly to help it maintain its softness, but that's not worked for me.
I've only seen it made. You know, I've seen it made by a home cook. But I've never actually done it myself. So I'm going to tell you what I saw. All right.
Great.
I'm trying to remember. It was like a 2-to-1, if I remember, with the sugar. But the thing I remember was that the first thing she did was she took the mochiko flour and she put almost an equal amount of water in it. And she mixed it really, really well. It shouldn't be too dry. So if you've got a cup of the mochiko flour, okay, which is really mochi flour, you know, it's sweetened rice flour. And I've seen it, by the way, in Asian markets. It's not super hard to find if any market carries Japanese ingredients. So let's say it was a cup. It was probably about 2/3 to 3/4 of a cup of water. So that would be mixed. And then it would be steamed for about 20 minutes. I've seen recipes, by the way, that put it in the microwave, but I did not see that done. So it's steamed about 20 minutes. And then the hot mochi goes into a pot, and over low heat, sugar is gradually added to it. And the sugar dissolves, and then it goes into the dough, and then you add a little more sugar. So it's like you're adding maybe double the amount of sugar to mochi, as you mentioned, you know, to the flour. So a cup of mochi.
Maybe add it by thirds, perhaps?
Exactly. Somewhere in that neighborhood, because what I saw her doing was the sugar would actually start to melt over the low heat. She didn't want it to burn, but she would keep stirring and stirring and stirring and stirring. And then she had a sheet, you know, like a pan, just covered, like a cookie sheet, covered with a bit of cornstarch so it wouldn't stick. And the mochi went on to that. The hot mochi went on to that. And when it was cool enough, it was shaped. And then the red bean paste is the aduki bean, right, that you cook and cook and cook, and then you cook sugar into it. And and that's the classic sweet bean paste that's used in much of, you know, I know certainly in China and in Japan. But the point is, then you can mold the mochi around that.
Gotcha.
Or I've had it where it's just molded around fresh fruit and a little bit of red bean paste goes like in the middle of the apricot. Then the mochi goes around it. So have you tried the idea of cooking the sugar into it very slowly after you've steamed the dough?
No, I have not. In fact, I think everything that I've done has been having the flour and the sugar mixed together and then steaming that.
Ah, this method, look, this is the method I saw. And I have a feeling mochi is like everything else that's very popular anywhere. There will be God knows how many different versions of it. But it's something that's fun to master. I think try this method and see how it works for you.
I will do that. That sounds great.
And I'm going to go and get some rice flour.
Well, you know, in Macon, Georgia, you have to get it on the internet.
I know what you mean. But you've got things in Macon I don't have.
There you go. Well, listen, you're my food sensei, so thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Billy. Enjoy. Bye.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. Now, add to your list of innovators in growing organic food a mother and son team. Jan Pilarski and her son, Chris Tidmarsh, mastermind the organic greenhouse operation, Greenbridge Growers. They're in South Bend, Indiana. Now, Jan and Chris have two goals. One is to grow food with the smallest carbon footprint possible. The other is to bring jobs to a group that has a 90% unemployment rate, the autistic. Chris is autistic. He's also earned a degree in chemistry and environmental studies. Jan saw him lose his first job and saw that 90% of the people with autism were unemployed. And that's where Greenbridge began. Jan Pilarski, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Lynn. So good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you. Now, Jan, Greenbridge Growers is a greenhouse business project, but you've put it together with a specific goal. What's the goal?
Yes, we have. We're an urban farm venture that is doing year-round growing, but specifically we have a social mission to employ young adults with autism through the work that we're doing in our local community. These young adults have great skills but are quite under-resourced in terms of being able to have an entry into the job force. So we have the dual mission of growing delicious local produce and creating jobs that are meaningful for these wonderful young adults.
Well, now, you and Chris together have developed a particular system. You've designed it. And that you said it's tailored for folks with autism, but can you give us an idea of what this system is? How does the greenhouse work, and how does it work for people with autism?
Sure. The system that we have uses a growing method called aquaponics, where fish and vegetables grow in tandem, and the plants grow within a water base, and the fish fertilize the plants with their waste. It's like the compost of the system. And the plants grow very productively, and wonderful herbs, cilantros, mints, basils, specialty greens, lettuces all do very well in this system. But what it really taps into so well is young adults with autism have a great propensity for scheduling, for routine, for really stick-to-itiveness to stay with a system and a process. And there's a lot of monitoring and precision and scheduling to aquaponics. And we found that as we're pioneering our prototype and working with young adults to do training, that this is something they're just soaking up and doing so well with, all of the monitoring and the checking that the water chemistry and taking care of the plants offers them.
Now, I understand. I saw a figure that said that 90% of the folks with autism are unemployed. That's a pretty stunning figure.
Right. And I think that shows the disconnect that there is between people being able to enter the workforce and use their skills and there being a place for these skills to be handily used. And in starting Greenbridge Growers, what we wanted to do was be entrepreneurial about this unemployment problem, this severe unemployment problem, trying to use these skills in a very productive fashion that will also produce good food for our area.
How many people do you employ in a greenhouse?
Each greenhouse will employ 5 workers who will tend to the care of our plants and to our fish. We also see potential down the line for other types of tasks related to the business, such as bookkeeping, computers, social media, as other things that people who have autism would do very handily and do very well. So really making use of those skills.
Well, good luck to you both and to everyone involved in the project.
Thank you so much.
Jan Pilarski and her son Chris Tidmarsh are the minds behind Green Bridge Growers in South Bend, Indiana. For more information on their work, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Brenda Shope, who said, "My grandfather used to say that once in your life, you'll need a doctor, a lawyer, and a policeman. But every day, 3 times a day, you need a farmer." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Go to splendidtable.org to get information on anything you heard here today. You can browse through our recipes, get registered for our podcasts, and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Look at our e-books, Eating In with Lynn, and we want to hear from you. So go to our Once Upon a Table, Tales of Eating with Mom and Dad, and contribute a recipe, a story, or a photo about eating with your mom and dad. And for your effort, we'll get you a brand new, never been published before menu with recipes to help celebrate your Father's Day. It's all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM. American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.